I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
close to home, six newcomers to Canada, four of them children, are dead after an attack in an Ottawa suburb. The city's mayor tells us he is grieving their loss, and for the father who survived.
Do it or lose it. San Francisco has voted to make drug tests mandatory for anyone receiving welfare in the city. And if you test positive, you have to enroll in free treatment or be stripped of your cash assistance.
Feeling the pinch, Louisiana declares a disaster for the crawfish industry. One crawfisher tells us his wild catch has dwindled dramatically, but says he'll keep at it to keep a piece of Cajun culture alive.
Feathering their nests, scores of songbirds in Cyprus are being trapped and killed. And you can blame the criminals whacking the tiny creatures for profit or the people paying to eat them for dinner.
When the chips are down, we told you about the fire that destroyed the Covered Bridge chip factory in New Brunswick. Well, the owner of that family business says he will rebuild with a little hope and a lot of help.
And according to plan, to mark Chopin's birthday, a Canadian pianist travels to the composer's childhood home in Poland to play a concert in the room where he was likely born. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that takes you on a Chopin spree. In Ottawa today, there is shock, there is grief, and there are questions. Six people were killed in the suburb of Barrhaven last night. As you've been hearing on the news, a Sri Lankan newcomer and her four children, ages 7, 4, 2, and 2 months, are dead, along with a 40-year-old acquaintance of the family. The children's father was injured but survived. Today, Ottawa Police Chief Eric Stubbs announced that the suspect is a 19-year-old from Sri Lanka, believed to be studying in Canada.
I want to emphasize, this was a senseless act of violence perpetrated on purely innocent people. I know our whole community is shocked and mourning this event. This one will undoubtedly weigh on the hearts of everyone for a long time.
The suspect has been charged with six counts of first-degree murder and a charge of attempted murder. Police have not offered any insight into what the motive might have been. Mark Sutcliffe is the mayor of Ottawa. That's where we reached him.
Mayor Sutcliffe, how did you find out what had happened?
I got a call from the police chief at about 5:30 this morning, and it was very shocking and disturbing to think of that type of event taking place in our community and in a wonderful neighborhood of Ottawa. Barrhaven is a very warm and welcoming community, a very multicultural and diverse part of the city, and especially to hear the ages of the children involved was very, very troubling and disturbing to me.
What is that conversation like at 5:30 in the morning? What does he say to you that you can share?
Yeah, he told me that there was a terrible event that had taken place, and it had happened late last night, and he described a little bit of what the emergency responders had arrived upon, and my heart goes out to the entire community and the people close to the victims and also to the emergency responders, because I can only imagine what it would be like to arrive on a scene as horrific as this one. And he told me that a suspect was in custody and that there was no ongoing threat to public safety, which I think was important to know and reassuring to the community that a suspect had been apprehended. And then we had a news briefing later today where they were able to share more information.
Relief, as you said, in that moment, but at the same time, so many questions still. What else can you tell us about this family and how long they had called Ottawa home?
I don't know exactly how long, but they've been described as relatively new arrivals to Canada and to Ottawa, and that's obviously very troubling because we know that so many people come to our city and to our country because they are looking for a better life, and some people are coming because they're trying to escape violence or poverty, and they come here because Canada has so much to offer and Ottawa has so much to offer, and one of the things we have to offer usually is that we're a peaceful country. And so for a family who came to this country presumably looking for a better life to have experienced this is incredibly shocking, and speaking personally as a father, I'm thinking about the fact that there's a father in hospital right now who has lost his entire family. He's lost his wife and his four children, and that breaks my heart. I can't even begin to imagine what he's going through and what he has experienced through this and continues to experience. And I've heard from many Ottawa residents that's part of what is so shocking to them is the fact that children were involved, and that there's a man in our community, a member of our community, who is going through this right now.
He's in hospital, as you mentioned. Do you have any sense of how he's doing?
I was told that he's in serious but stable condition.
Will you have a chance to speak with him? It sounds like you haven't yet, but is that something you'd like to do?
I've been thinking about that all day, to be honest, and I would like to if I have the chance, because, you know, what you hope for as a member of the community, and certainly what you hope for as mayor, is that everybody in your community goes to bed at night feeling safe and secure and wakes up in the morning looking forward to the day, and just to know that the horror that this family experienced and that this man experienced, this father and husband experienced, is really troubling to me. And if there's anything that we as a community can do to support him, we will be there for him.
You mentioned your own children, your own family. How do you discuss this? What do you say?
It's very difficult to think of any words to share with my kids. I spoke briefly with my son this morning on the way to school. I was driving him in, and there are no words to describe this. And I tried to reassure him, as I am trying to reassure all Ottawa residents, that this is an incredibly rare event in our city and in our country. And it's so shocking and disturbing and frankly, just so sad. Mm-hmm. And we just have to be thankful for the fact that we all live in a safe community, and for whatever reason, it wasn't safe for this family last night. And we have to pull together as a community and support each other. And we have to continue to look out for each other and put our arms around each other and be grateful for every day that we have.
One of the questions people always ask in horrific cases like this, and certainly we'll look to you as mayor, even though there's an investigation underway, of course, and charges have been laid. But the question that people always ask is why, mayor? And how do you try to answer that now?
I can't answer it. I wish I could, and I don't know if we'll ever get a full answer. I can't understand, as a human being, as a father, as a family member, as a member of this community, it's so disturbing. I can't offer an explanation, and I'm not even sure I'll ever receive a satisfactory explanation to that.
You've spoken in the past, Mayor, about your own family, their decision to come to Canada, to Ottawa, to begin a new life. Have you spoken to your mother since this news came out?
I haven't spoken to my mother yet. I'll be seeing her later today, and you know, I'm sure we'll talk about what's been in the news today. And it's, you know, we're, again, Ottawa is a wonderful community, and my mother's family's experience coming here from Asia was great for them. You know, they found what they were looking for after escaping a very difficult situation where they came from, and that's what so many families want when they come to Ottawa and come to Canada. And it's just such a tragedy that this family will not have that wonderful Canadian experience that so many others have had, that those children will never grow up and take full advantage of what Ottawa and Canada have to offer.
Mayor Sutcliffe, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mark Sutcliffe is the mayor of Ottawa. It's a disaster, officially. That is the word from the governor of Louisiana, who announced yesterday that the crawfish farming industry in his state had been hit so hard that it should qualify for federal aid. The disaster declaration comes after saltwater intrusion into the Mississippi River and extreme weather, including a drought and a hard winter freeze, all of which have decimated the population of crawfish, a small lobster-like crustacean that's been a defining symbol for the state for generations, especially in the Cajun community. Jody Mesh is a crawfisher and the former president of the Louisiana Crawfish Producers Association. We reached him in Henderson, Louisiana.
Jody, the governor's declaration is aimed specifically at crawfish farmers. You're fishing for them in the wild.
Correct.
So
I don't fall into that declaration right now.
Does that worry you?
Yes, it does, because historically, in years past, always the wild crawfish producers were left out of relief, and I worked hard to try to get relief for the wild crawfish fishermen when the CARES Act monies came to help the farmers when the markets were shut down for COVID, and we were unable to get any relief. So, yeah, I am worried that we're going to be left out in the cold, so to speak, again with this issue. But, I mean, I commend the governor on doing the work that he's doing as far as helping to declare these disaster declarations, and I hope he would do the same for the wild crawfish producers. You know?
What are you going to do in the meantime?
Well, in the meantime, it's like I'm picking pecans to make a living. You know, last year at this time, I was catching anywhere from 17, 18 up into 20-somewhat sacks per day for the last couple of months. And just recently, I ran traps Monday, I ran traps Tuesday, and I ran traps Wednesday. I caught two sacks Monday, I caught 3.5 sacks Tuesday, and I caught a sack and a half yesterday. So my production is minimal compared to last year at this time. So we've been impacted by the drought extensively in the Atchafalaya Basin also.
What keeps you
wild production.
What keeps you heading out there when you know it's so bad?
Well, I love my culture, and I love Louisiana, and I love my way of life. And it makes me feel good to be able to produce something that's so unique to the whole world, that people come from all over the world to get a taste of our Cajun way of life, our Cajun cuisine, our wonderful Cajun crawfish. You know what I'm saying? Because that's what crawfish is known for. It got its start in the swamps of Louisiana by wild crawfish fishermen. And I'm passionate about what I do. And it makes me feel good to provide something to the people that they love so much to come and enjoy the festiveness and come and enjoy our wonderful crawfish. So I'm going to keep trying to go out there and catch them.
I can hear how much you care in your voice. This is not just a job for you.
It chokes me up to talk about it. Because, you know, my dad would be 100 years old today. He would have made 100 on February 4th. And, you know, my family, we've been participating in the wild crawfish part of the industry for probably 7 decades. So it's really close to my heart and close to home for me, you know. And all of the other fishermen who I speak on behalf of, you know, we're descendants of that original group of Acadians who came from Acadie, you know, when we were banished to the swamps of Louisiana. And we're keeping our way of life alive by going out into the wilds of the swamps of Louisiana and producing something that is unique to the whole world, you know. So it really means a lot to me to provide something that's so delicious and unique and wonderful to people who love to come and eat them here in Louisiana.
How do you prepare, Jody, for this kind of ongoing extreme weather, more unpredictable weather? You know, are you worried that crawfishing in the wild might be unsustainable in the long run?
Oh, yes, definitely. As compared to, let's say, 5-6 decades ago, the production out of the wild is minimal as compared to several decades ago. We used to produce more wild crawfish in St. Martin Parish, which is here in Louisiana, than we'd produce sugarcane. You follow what I'm saying? And that has diminished, I mean, unbelievably. The majority of the production now is from crawfish farmers and pond production. But we still produce a considerable amount, you know, of wild crawfish. But, yeah, I worry about it not continuing to be sustainable. But I continue to do it because I feel like it's keeping my dad and my grandfather, like, alive with me. You know, I feel their presence when I'm in the wild. And I'm continuing to catch those crawfish in the same places that they made their living so many years ago, you know. And, yeah, it's just something that is a part of who you are. It kind of defines what you're about and who you are. But, yeah, the conditions, I mean, I don't know if we're going to have a bountiful harvest in the next few months. I'm hopeful. You know, I'm a realist. I'm not really an optimist or a pessimist. I'm a realist, but I'm a hopeful realist. I hope that it's going to get better. And you know, I told someone, I said, I do like that squirrel. You know, that squirrel, when the trees are full of nuts, he goes and he gathers up a bunch of nuts and he saves them and he rat holes those nuts and he has a supply of nuts when the next time the harvest season is not as good and not as many nuts in to eat. Yeah. So he has nuts saved up that he can survive on. Well, in past seasons, I've saved up my nuts, so I'm kind of surviving on my nuts that I've saved up the past.
Smart planning. Like that smart squirrel. Planning. Well, what are customers telling you?
Well, customers are disappointed in the high prices, but mainly, more than anything, they're disappointed because of the lack of availability.
Because people would eat it now during Lent, right, especially?
Oh, yes. It's a huge time of year, especially Louisiana, during Lent time. Everybody loves to eat their ball crawfish or crawfish etouffee, all of the numerous delicious dishes that we're known for here in South Louisiana, you know. So the state as a whole is taking a huge lick from this this poor start, terrible start to a crawfish season. But the farmers and the wild crawfishermen are really taking a serious lick, no doubt.
Do you think you'll break even this year?
I'm hopeful that I will. You know, I'm hopeful. You know, I go to work with a prayer in my heart every day. And I trust that God is going to provide me with an income for my family and with a way of life. And so far, I'm 54 years old, and there's always, you know, when there's a will, my old mom used to say, when there's a will, there's a way. So I go back the next day or the next week or so, and I run my traps, and I'm hoping that I have more crawfish to the trap than I did the last time, you know.
Jody, thank you very much for your time. You take care.
You have a great day.
You too.
Jody Mesh is a crawfisher and the former president of the Louisiana Crawfish Producers Association. We reached him in Henderson, Louisiana. This next update might come as somewhat of a comfort to potato chip enthusiasts. Earlier this week, we told you about the Covered Bridge potato chip factory, which burned to the ground on Friday. That was obviously a serious blow to staff and to the business, as well as everyone who loves the New Brunswick chip brand. But owner Ryan Albright says plans to rebuild are slowly getting underway, and he is hopeful. But he did tell our colleagues in New Brunswick that there's a long road ahead.
We want to build back in the same spot in Carroll County, but we have to get through so much first and insurance and all that to help on how fast that's going to be and what it looks like. And I'm always the optimist, so I'm going to shoot for the moon and as quick as we can. But we just don't want the shelves to completely drain out right now. We want to make sure that we get, you know, we have a little bit in warehousing to scatter around, but we want to get some more product on the way. We do have raw materials, so we're hoping there won't be a huge gap.
You have another facility in mind for the interim?
Yeah, so we only have personally one facility, but we're looking at getting some help from some other manufacturers. It's about, we have all the raw materials for our product to make what we make, and now it's just about, okay, now how do we make that elsewhere in order to buy us time to get the building back up and running in the same location. You know, we have some long-term relationships with a lot of snack food companies for the last 20 years. Being a potato grower originally, we do sell product to a lot of other potato chip companies that have reached out with a helping hand, trying to see if they can help us in any way, and so we're exploring that right now.
Should people be worried that the shelves are going to go dry in their local grocery store right now?
Look, the plan is to not have it, not have them run dry, but you know, there's definitely going to be a small gap here and there depending on locations. We're hoping we can start getting product made quite quickly. There's been a huge outreach though from the public, which is amazing. Like, people that support us have always supported us, and then people that never even maybe had our product, to friends from 30 years ago I've had, employees, and you know, I've been trying to reply to everybody that's reached out as quickly as I can, and it's been really good for myself, my family, and the whole Covered Bridge Chips family too.
Ryan Albright is the founder and owner of Covered Bridge Potato Chips. He was talking to CBC New Brunswick's Aidan Cox. In Poland recently, music lovers gathered to celebrate Frédéric Chopin's 214th birthday. The composer himself could not attend, but a 21-year-old Canadian did. That is him you just heard, playing a key role by playing the keys. Eric Guo is a fourth-year Bachelor of Music student at the Royal Conservatory's Glenn Gould School. Last year, he won the second international Chopin competition on period instruments organized by Poland's Chopin Institute. That sent him on an international tour. Eric got back from Poland on Monday. We reached him in Toronto today.
Eric, congratulations and welcome back.
Thanks, Neil. It's a great honor and pleasure, and really happy to talk to you.
Oh, well, likewise. When you're playing, it's certainly beautiful for us to listen to, but do you feel connected to and close to Chopin as you play?
Of course, and there's no better way than to play in Jazzowa Wola, and of course in Warsaw. But Jazzowa Wola is, you know, the place that he was born, and especially probably the very same room that I played in was where he was born. And, you know, to play there, I just feel it's really an honor.
I love how the Associated Press put it. They said pianist Eric Guo did everything but travel through time to commune
exactly.
with Chopin. Is it, how would you describe, besides being an honor, I mean, how would you describe the feeling in your body as you go to play and play there, as you've said?
I feel like linked really close to Chopin, and you know, to feel how it is, especially on the period instruments. The recital I played in Rzeszowa Wola was an Erard 1838 original, and this was one of those pianos during his time, and he likely would have played on these instruments. And you know, the sound it can create, it's really just out of this world, and I feel it's just magical, and all the colors and possibilities of, you know, layers and nuances and the touch is just incredible. And really, this is what Chopin would have tried to pursue in his own playing with these instruments, and the sound that he would have looked for.
That was in the first performance of the day. Then in the evening, you were playing in the concert hall on two pianos. Tell us about those instruments, because they were significant in their own way.
Yes, in the evening at the Warsaw Philharmonic, one of the greatest halls, I believe, if not the best in the world, I chose two pianos, both Pleyel, made by Pleyel. The first half I played on a copy of a Pleyel 1830 by Paul McNulty, really world-renowned maker of over 300 copies of these instruments. And he's really been truly a best friend. And the second half was a Pleyel 1848, which is original. This is a collection from the Chopin Institute in Warsaw. This is also a magnificent instrument, which, you know, this is 1848 is, this is the last year of Chopin's life. It really suits the late Chopin. And the 1830 is around the time that he wrote the F minor concerto. So it's really suiting that, yeah.
As much as you love Chopin and connecting with Chopin, that is a lot of Chopin for one day.
Yeah.
You also won a Chopin competition last year. You've been on tour playing Chopin. Do you ever get sick of all the Chopin? Do you ever just want to play some, I don't know, Beethoven?
Well, I mean, I don't think one can ever get tired or bored of Chopin.
I thought you might say that.
Yeah, I mean, despite playing so many of, especially the same works, whether it's Barcarolle or a waltz or mazurka, you know, all these pieces are just miraculous gems in this creations, masterpieces. Of course, like you say, Beethoven, which I also adore as much as Chopin. You know, Chopin is my favorite composer, and Beethoven probably would rank the second. But, you know, Chopin, I feel just, it's always been in my life since when I was young.
Do you remember, you know, when you were first learning, you know, your first piece, your first Chopin piece?
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's the first Chopin piece was actually the Nocturne, you know, the famous one in E-flat major, Opus 9, number 2. I was sight reading from my previous teacher. You know, he kind of assigned it to me and then to audition for a new teacher. So I used this piece as my kind of first audition. And, you know, of course, it was terrible. And, you know, I was sight reading, you know. And, you know, my mom at that time was anxious, like, if I can do it, yeah. You know, how is it possible? But, of course, after two lines, the teacher stopped me and asked me, why do you like Chopin? And I said, because it's romantic. And, you know, at that time, I couldn't think of any other words. And, you know,
how old were you?
Probably, you know, around nine years old, actually. Yeah, so... But I, you know, immediately the teacher felt I have this connection with Chopin so well, and he accepted me as a student. And, you know, from then on, Chopin has become my life, you know, really. It's, music is life, and life is music, especially, I think, classical music.
You're making me want to learn piano. you know, in 2019... I hope, I don't think I'll get to your level, but you're making a great case for it. In 2019, you were named one of CBC's 30 Hot Canadian Classical Musicians Under 30 list. You were 17 at that time, and you said, quote, I feel that 24 hours in a day is not enough for me. Besides practicing piano, sleeping is my favorite thing. Is that still true? Do you have enough time now?
Right. Yeah. Well, exactly. I forgot that I said that, even the sleeping during then. And it's been always, you know, besides music, and of course I love reading books more now, and I love nature and hiking mountains. I've always been to China before the pandemic every year to just visit tourist attractions and nature and, you know, mountains. I just love everything about it. I think it's really helpful for my music making.
Yeah, so you're finding more of a balance, it sounds like. Still sleeping, though, but doing some other things.
Yes, exactly. Sleeping even, you know, in before a concert and anywhere I go, you know. That's the number one thing besides food, actually, also, which I'm also very strong about.
Likewise. Yeah. We have lots of similarities. Well, congratulations again, Eric, and enjoy the ride. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, it's been really, and also very honored to represent Canada and the Glenn Gould School. I'm really proud to be Canadian, of the second generation from China, Chinese immigrants in my family. And to just really thanks to all people and family and support, and also to CBC for,
That's okay.
And all of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.
21-year-old pianist Eric Guo in Toronto.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Last year, San Francisco recorded more accidental overdose deaths than ever before. 813 people died, and 4 of every 5 of those deaths involved fentanyl. Now voters are sending a clear message about the drug crisis. They want a more aggressive response from the city. This week, people voted in favor of a measure called Proposition F. It would require adults who receive cash assistance from the city to be tested for drugs, and if they test positive, they must start a free treatment program. Jennifer Friedenbach is the executive director for the Coalition on Homelessness. We reached her in San Francisco.
Jennifer, from where you sit, what does Prop F say to people you work with?
Yeah, you know, for us, it's really deeply disturbing. We're in the middle of an unprecedented overdose epidemic, and we really needed some serious solutions to this. And instead, voters got a misleading and performative ballot issue that demonizes welfare recipients rather than helps them.
What do you mean by demonizes them rather than helps them? What were people misinformed about?
Well, this whole initiative was, you know, a wedge issue to put on the ballot to drive billionaire. You know, we have a lot of billionaires investing in trying to swing San Francisco to the right. And this was, you know, really part of a mayor race and a lot of information out there, you know, about welfare recipients living off the dime, using their welfare for drugs. Very classic wedge issue in California where and coded racism, you know, using terminology like welfare queens and so forth to really drive more conservatives to the ballot.
There is a very real problem in San Francisco. Our listeners heard about the more than 800 people who died, how many of those deaths involved fentanyl. Those deaths were from accidental overdoses and other issues at play. So Mayor London Breed, who we should say declined our request for an interview, did tell the San Francisco Chronicle that Propositions E and F, E, you know, expands police powers or gives police a little more flexibility, she said, will give her the kinds of tools I need to continue the work we're doing to improve public safety and respond to the drug crisis. She's saying these are necessary tools and will help the city and help people who are addicted and suffering.
And that's the message that went out to voters. The reality is that the way it'll work is that people will be profiled over the phone as drug users and will be mandated to do an assessment. And that assessment, if they miss that appointment or miss future appointments, they'll be cut off of assistance. We have huge holes in our treatment system. Over half of the people trying to get treatment are being turned away. This proposal is going to mandate people into treatment, taking up the slots of people who want treatment and who that treatment would be effective for. On the flip side, we know mandated treatment increases overdose rates and really has the opposite effect of addressing our overdose crises. And certainly when folks lose their housing, that also increases substance use. So this wasn't very well thought out and wasn't serious. It was really about a political ploy.
Where do you see the people that you work with, the thousands of people that this proposition will directly impact, where do you see them in a year?
Well, you know, we'll keep working hard to increase access to housing for folks so that they can stabilize. We're going to keep working to make sure that when people are finished with the treatment program, they don't go back to the street. Most of the folks are living in informal housing situations. We know welfare department doesn't have any mechanism whatsoever to continue, you know, to pay rent if they do cut off the cash assistance. So there's just a lot of work to be done to try to reduce the harm, but you know, it's going to be an uphill battle because, frankly, you know, the policymakers in San Francisco who put this on the ballot don't really care. If they did care, they would have been consulting with addiction experts and looking at the data and doing something that was going to actually solve the issue. This is just political games.
So now, Jennifer, that this measure has passed, are you going to encourage the people you work with to report and to follow whatever guidelines Proposition F sets out, despite the fact that you deeply disagree with it?
Oh, well, yeah, we could encourage them. I mean, they're obviously going to try to follow it because they don't want to lose their housing, so they don't need any encouragement from us. But the way that these things work is it has less to do with desire and more to do with the fact that folks are living in severe poverty and have a lot of barriers, you know, or living in housing with crappy mail service and don't get the notices. It's all about whether they're able to meet a very complicated requirements that are put forward to them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's more than 50 reasons to get cut off of welfare, and this is just adding more. And we have several hundred people every month who lose their welfare because they were not able to, you know, respond. I mean, getting you know, any kind of benefit in the United States, I mean, it's really set up to help as few people as possible by design. So they make it really complicated, and the folks that aren't able to maneuver that, those complicated bureaucracies are the ones that end up back out on the streets and end up getting, you know, the negative results mm-hmm. of these kind of policies.
And what are folks telling you now that they're learning this news? Has anyone said anything to you?
Folks are really disheartened. Yeah, I mean, we met an unhoused person the other day that literally walked 3 miles to vote in order to put in the ballot to put in a no on F, and of course he was really really upset that it passed because he saw it for what it is, just a political game that was demonizing people that are in his same situation.
When you see that 63% though that voted in favor of this, what does that tell you?
The way that I look at it is that, you know, a lot of money was spent by billionaires. Some of them didn't even know what they were putting money into to mislead voters. And so, you know, it's not surprising that voters supported this because they want to do right by folks. They want folks to end up in treatment. If they think, you know, this could help, then they're going to support it. And but, you know, these are complicated socioeconomic issues, and you know, they didn't even need to put this on the ballot. They could have made the change if they wanted to without the ballot. So the whole thing is just a farce. And unfortunately, when you've got billionaires spending, you know, just god-awful amounts of money that actually could have helped folks to mislead voters, then these are the results we get.
Jennifer, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Jennifer Friedenbach is the executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness. We reached her in San Francisco. There are a lot of vices traditionally associated with organized crime, but until today, if you'd asked me to make a list of those vices, I can guarantee that slaughtering songbirds would not have been on it. But according to a new report out of Cyprus, illegal poaching killed some 400,000 birds on that island last autumn alone. The study was compiled by the local conservation organization BirdLife Cyprus, and its director says it speaks to a problem that could easily get worse. We reached Martin Helikar in Nicosia.
Martin, why is this happening? Why are hundreds of thousands of songbirds being killed in Cyprus?
Well, essentially, this is happening because there's a lot of money to be made out of this illegal activity. The eating of trapped songbirds has its roots in tradition in Cyprus, but what is happening today, it's important to stress, bears no relation to tradition in any way. First of all, we're talking about something that will have developed in a peasant culture at a time when people didn't have probably much meat to eat. And it's also important to point out that when this tradition started, there were a lot of birds around.
And this practice was outlawed in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, the practice has been illegal in Cyprus since 1974. The practice itself has also changed dramatically compared to the traditional way of doing it, which would have been quite a small, possibly sustainable take. Mm-hmm. And in particular, it's changed when you have mist nets introduced. But in addition to that, the trappers now use tape lures, which blast out the song of the blackcap and other birds, drawing them in to trapping sites. So this multiplies the catch very significantly.
I was looking at some of the photographs, what you and your colleagues come across, or others come across these birds that are trapped. Just describe how you're finding them, the kind of state and how they've been trapped.
It really is very ugly, quite horrific, especially on the lime stick. They get tangled.
I should say a lime stick is a branch that's covered in glue, right?
Yeah, we should explain that. It's just a straight branch of a pomegranate bush or something like that, and it's covered in glue. And then the trapper comes along and pops their skull or bites their throat and throws them into a bucket. So it's not a pretty thing, to put it mildly. But perhaps more important to stress the real problem with this is that it's completely non-selective. So more than 150 different species of bird do fall victim to this. So, you know, species among which we have some very threatened types of birds.
What makes you believe organized crime is to blame?
Well, the evidence is out there in the field. There's big trapping sites that are actually quite well known. It's not something that anyone actually disputes, that organized crime is important in this in Cyprus. We estimate that over 400,000 birds may have been caught. And a plate of these songbirds served up as ambelopulia, this delicacy, which is a dozen birds, can sell for anything between 80 and 100 euros. So we're talking millions that can be made out of this. So it'll be part of a mafia gang's portfolio, along with gambling and drugs and prostitution.
Where is it being served? I mean, you're not walking into any cafe or restaurant.
Certainly not. Very good question. No, it's not. I mean, it used to be served much more openly, but luckily there's been greater enforcement. So now it's much more undercover. You need to know where to go. You need to know how to ask for it. But we've also seen an increasing trend where people are consuming it more at home, but it is available still, unfortunately.
You mentioned, you know, the historical significance, the cultural significance. Is there a way to do this that it is, in your view, more sustainable and more ethical? Because I can hear sort of elders potentially saying, we always, you know, we always did this. It wasn't a problem before.
No, there isn't really a way you can get around the non-selective nature of this. So the proponents of catching songbirds and serving them up in this way often suggest that they could be shot. But the thing is, in the field, there are many closely related, similar-looking species, some of which are actually very threatened, and they're difficult to distinguish even for an experienced bird watcher with a good pair of binoculars.
The number of birds killed in Cyprus, I was reading each year, used to be higher than it is now. So you had some success in your work, but why is it climbing again now?
We've had a lot of success. You're right. If you go back 20, 30 years, we've reduced the levels of the slaughter by over 90%. The little blip, I hope it is going to be just a blip, is down to, as far as we can tell, three factors. Part of the problem is in the British base areas in Cyprus. In fact, it used to be a very big part of the problem, but it's a really good place for migrant birds. And until recently, the base has turned a blind eye to it. But they have changed that, and it is a success story. However, last autumn, and autumn is the main season for catching migrant birds in Cyprus, they took the pressure off in terms of the number of police out there in the field patrolling. They did correct it once we alerted them to this, but the trappers are in there straight away if you take the enforcement pressure off, because the market is still there and strong. The other reason is that, unfortunately, there's been a relaxation in the law around lime sticks, reducing fines significantly, effectively actually decriminalizing lime stick. And the other thing, which we touched on earlier on, is that there hasn't been effective, determined enforcement action against the big mafia-style organized trappers. So they continue to operate. So we just need enforcement to be strict for the next few years until we and other organizations can complete our job of changing hearts and minds about this. We do a lot of work in schools, and we do see a change, but it will be a while before the children we're talking to in schools will be decision makers.
Martin, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Martin Helikar is the director of BirdLife Cyprus. We reached him in Nicosia. Around this time of year, if you live in Toronto and you're into birds, you could probably spot black-capped chickadees, a few dark-eyed juncos if you're lucky, and of course a bumper crop of beautiful iridescent feathered birds called pigeons. But this late winter slash early spring, Toronto birders have something new to get excited about. The news that a rare bald eagle nest can be found somewhere in or around the city. It's the first ever documented in Toronto. Jules McCusker is an Indigenous artist who works near the bald eagle nest location. He's not saying where exactly to keep people away. We reached him at that secret location in Toronto.
Jules, how's the nest doing?
Oh, well, really well. The pair are seemingly pretty active and quite settled in.
What does that activity look like?
Well, kind of dull for the most part.
Slow living.
If you're familiar with them, they can sit for hours and not even move.
Meditative.
Yeah, they're very meditative. And then when they take off, they do a beautiful circle routine, and they go up and down the canals and out onto the lake, and it's quite a beautiful sight.
How often are they doing that? How often do you see them flying?
Daily. Daily, they're you know, they're actively hunting and dealing with their daily sustenance and their morning routine and their evening routine.
When did you first find out about the nest?
It was verified a few weeks ago, maybe like four weeks ago or something like that. I don't know. It hasn't been that long to verify the nest.
How did you get wind of it? Because you didn't find it yourself.
No. I saw them earlier, but I didn't locate them. I actually didn't think the nest was possible. I kind of was skeptical.
Yeah.
You know?
Because it is a
first.
So when somebody
did verify, they were like, oh, yeah, no, I've seen them in there. I'm like, you're kidding me. Really? So it's very cool.
Who were you having that conversation with?
A couple of the locals.
Yeah.
So there's a handful of people that, you know, do their morning routines pretty bright and early and they're pretty aware of the surroundings. Not everyone is. However, it's sort of similar to me. It's like, wow, is that what I think I see? I'm like, God, it is.
There must be a lot of buzz.
It's actually pretty quiet.
About people's excitement.
I think we're all more concerned than excited.
Okay. Why?
Because it's such a fragile circumstance. It's the first time ever. The word of 100 years and so forth is actually really accurate. There's, according to a few different officials, there's never been a recorded nest. And so, when they were pretty much hunted out into extinction in this area, and it's kind of funny that the timing is incredible because it was just only a couple of months ago that one of the department officials lifted the status of endangered species for them, like literally just a couple of months ago. Mm. So it's seemingly that there's a broader resurgence in the province of Ontario overall.
We've said you're in Toronto, but we're not disclosing the exact location because everyone wants to keep the nest safe because it is so rare, as you've said. But, you know, bird watchers can get pretty excited. Other people who want to take a picture. Have people been bugging you to tell them where it is?
No, actually not at this
we're
point
so polite.
Anyway. I'm not a birder, but I know some birders and they were all very much like, oh, it's a whisper network. It's not like we want that happening either. So, it's a pretty respectful bunch for the most part. And I think they all are aware that there's yahoos. There's people that could, you know, possibly endanger or harm them or look for a trophy of their own of some kind. It's a messed up world we live in, but this is a pretty beautiful circumstance.
And what are the experts telling you so far about why? I mean, you mentioned the resurgence potentially, but why they picked this spot and why now?
Nobody knows. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows that particular answer. I can only make like the Coots Paradise people who've been engaged with their eagles since 2012, and they've been hosting and creating an environment that has been positive for them. So they had a pair of eaglets, which were the first eaglets in 50 years around 2014. And so that was like a landmark moment. Yeah. And they largely attribute it to the fact that the waterways have been the cleanest they've ever been in 50 years.
Our CBC News Toronto colleagues quoted a friend of yours, an Indigenous artist, Duke Redbird. Mm-hmm. He says the return of these eagles to Ontario is a good omen, a good sign. What do you think?
Oh, it's huge. It's a pockle. I mean, you can't even put words around it. I come from Alberta, where we have a lot of eagles, and you know, growing up there and visiting British Columbia and the mountains, I mean, eagles are pretty commonplace. Coming out here, finding out that you know, you just don't ever see them. So it's incredible. It's huge.
Are you hoping for eaglets?
Oh, yeah, 100%. 100%. And, you know, I'm also cautious, like, to let other people know, like, they're not predatory in that context. Like, mm-hmm. they'll abandon their eggs if they feel it's not a good spot. They'll even abandon their young if they feel it's not. You know, not where they want to be. Mm-hmm. And they can even take a few years before they decide that they're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, it's important, very life decisions.
Conscientious animal, eh?
Yes, very important life decisions. So is checking up on them, checking in on them, part of your daily routine now?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
If they did leave, would you be devastated?
Oh, yeah. It'd be just, like, heartbreaking.
Oh.
But at the same time, I'm more concerned for them. You know, I'm like, good on you. Like, if you don't like it here, skedaddle, right?
Jules, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Jules McCusker is somewhere in Toronto. The species has been all but decimated. Now the race is on to restore the sunflower sea star population, and the success of one team in California marks a big step forward in that effort. Recently at the Birch Aquarium, scientists were able to fertilize millions of sunflower sea star eggs in the lab, giving new hope for the species' recovery. Melissa Torres is an aquarist at the Birch Aquarium near San Diego. That's where we reached her.
Melissa, these larvae are at a critical stage. How are they doing right now?
They're doing great right now, continuing to develop and developing quite slowly as we're holding them colder than most other partners here in California.
Valentine's Day, if we rewind, was a big day. That's when you found out you were successful in fertilizing these eggs. Can you take me to that moment?
Oh, it was a wonderful moment. We decorated, we got excited, we were able to successfully induce both of these sea stars with an enzyme that allows them to want to spawn. They both successfully spawned, which was a very big deal for us. And then we were able to take both of those gametes and again successfully fertilize all of the eggs with all three types of frozen sperm we had. Another huge success for us. And now we're all trying to raise these babies so that we have some more animals to put back in the wild someday.
What's the celebration for something like that on Valentine's Day, no less?
For us, it was a long road to get to this very successful block in this roadmap, and so it was a lot of jumping and hugging and hooraying and screaming of excitedness of the fact that we've finally gotten to a point of building these blocks up to a successful moment.
How long have you been working to that moment?
Since 2019, early 2019, we've been collaborating with multiple partners in the state of California and trying to get to this moment.
It sounds like a very invasive procedure for these creatures, albeit important based on what you're saying. How do you go about doing this?
Yes, and anytime we're handling any of our animals, we do take that into consideration on how they accept that handling and how they deal with that. So we try to be as hands-off as possible. When we do handle them, we do it quickly and very softly and gently. So we did move them from their exhibit tank into a holding tank to be able to manage this, but that holding tank is very shallow and now no longer needs us to handle that animal. So we can actually be comfortable moving around in this little holding bin while we are doing something that seems a little more invasive. We do go in and inject them with a needle. We go in at a 45-degree angle so it slips in nice and easily. We don't really have to pop through anything that's difficult or hard. And at that point now, they can move freely around the tank. We use an IV extension to allow them to move freely while we take a very long time to inject this enzyme so that it is not too stressful for them taking a new liquid into their body.
And I know they can't understand what you're saying, but are you talking to them as you do this? I would imagine that you might be.
We do. You're right. They don't understand what we're saying, but putting them in a very comfortable environment for them and for us is very nice. So, you know, we do kind of talk to them, let them know that everything's going well, and, you know, they can't hear us, they're underwater, but it makes us feel better. And at the same time, we can watch their body language and how they're reacting, and if they're moving very fast, that might be something we're doing difficult for them, and we can either slow up the injection or add some more water to the tank or something that will allow them to then change back to looking more comfortable in the situation.
And you were using fresh and frozen sperm to do this, so what should it tell us that, that both of those methods were successful?
They were, and we're really excited about this. And the purpose of using the fresh and frozen sperm is to see if, in human care, if these animals spawn at a time that we don't have eggs, can we hold this sperm for a later time when we do have eggs to be able to then fertilize then and not miss that opportunity?
What we haven't talked about is what they look like. I've seen some pictures, but if people are imagining, you know, a beautiful little starfish that you might see on the shore, this is not that. It's still beautiful, but it's much bigger. Just describe what they look like.
So once these animals grow to adult size, if not full adult size, they can be as large as an extra large pizza. Some people talk about manhole covers, depending on what you're familiar to, but they can be up to a whole meter in diameter. If
much
not
prettier
larger
than manhole covers.
Yes, very much prettier. They can have up to 24 arms. And each one of those arms underneath is covered in those tube feet that allow them to crawl quickly across the ocean bottom, as well as capture prey, hold on to it, and be able to eat it. They can also be a range of colors, from white to pink to purple. So they're so beautiful. And when you actually get a look at them, they do look exactly like you'd imagine a sunflower or a sun that just has all these beautiful rays coming off of a central disc.
What determines the different colors?
A lot of the time it has to do with the habitat they're living in and the food that they are eating off of.
How did it get to the point that these are functionally extinct in California and in Oregon? How did that happen?
Well, back in 2013, the blob, a very hot water blob, basically built up on the west coast of California. And this hot water, warmer water, has not dissipated enough over these multiple years, causing these animals to basically what's called waste away. Majority of the inside of this animal is water. They pull the water in from the ocean and live their life with that water. And the water being too warm did not allow them to be able to healthily live their life. So with this warming water, they all, about 90% of them, wasted away. And now we have functional extinction in the state of Oregon and California, with a, lucky enough to say we do have them in the state of Washington and further north.
What is their impact, their role in our ecosystem? They're beautiful, as we've said. You're clearly fascinated by them. But what's their broader function?
Their main role in the ecology of the Pacific Northwest kelp forest is to keep that ecology at an eco-balance by foraging on the sea urchins that forage on the kelp. Without these sea stars to forage on these sea urchins, we have actually lost the majority of our kelp forests along the Pacific Northwest coast. And these kelp forests provide not only homes, but food for animals, as well as carbon sequestration and providing food and other condiments for human care as well.
This is all happening in captivity, of course, all of your work over these years. But at the end of the line, or when you look into the future, what's your dream for this? Where does this research lead?
Oh, as if we all and the SAFE C-STAR, Sunflower C-STAR program have our way, we would love to explant these populations back out into the wild and be able to see the wild populations come back in a way that allowed the ecology of the kelp forest to settle back out into its natural state.
Melissa, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Have a great day, Neil.
You too.
Melissa Torres is an aquarist at the Birch Aquarium near San Diego. That's where we reached her. It's the sound of thousands of Philadelphia Phillies fans. The sound, if you listen closely, of high-sodium missiles hurtling through the air, carrying shirt-threatening payloads of mustard. And the sound of a tradition ending. Now, that was the sound on April 11th, 2023. Dollar Dog Night at Citizens Bank Park. A 27-year tradition at several Phillies games every year, wherein fans get hot dogs for a dollar apiece. Ordinarily, a relatively peaceful event, putting aside the widespread gastrointestinal violence. But on that fateful day, things and hot dogs got out of hand. Robert Kristovich was there.
It started in our section. It started with them having hot dog eating contests. And this kid was eating a bunch of hot dogs. He had 13. They were trying to get them to, you know, people were like, eat another one, eat another one. So they started throwing hot dogs to him. The guard came over and started yelling, and then it just went nuts.
Well, now the Phillies are calling off the dogs. No more dollar dog nights. The team's senior VP of ticket operations and project says it's partly because of congestion around concession stands, but, quote, obviously, you know, the throwing was a little bit of a tipping point, unquote. Phillies fans are upset. And not to rub it in, but today the Toronto Blue Jays sent out an email to fans with the subject line, Loony Dogs Night is back. I don't know if that's good news or bad news for Jody Matheson and Ryan Rushton of Grimsby, Ontario, but I can tell you that Jody and Ryan are prominently featured in the Blue Jays promotional materials, standing there, eating hot dogs in their hot dog costumes. They are the Loony Dog Kings. Last season between them, they ate 245 hot dogs, an achievement so impressive, so harrowing, that they were invited to throw out the first pitch. Neil spoke with them last September.
Jody, what did the final Loony Dog of the season taste like?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because there's the real answer, and then there's the more emotional answer.
We'll take both.
This was my personal record there, so it was a difficult last Loony Dog of the season. I left feeling full in every way possible.
Well played. When you say difficult, though, is it because you couldn't keep it down?
Oh, well, I wish that was the case. We've done this enough times where we kind of know our limit.
Ryan, what about you? I mean, do you lose a sense of taste at some point?
Unfortunately, no. but I do have to say, you know, we were inspired by some other fans who were hanging out on Schneider's porch to, you know, bring in our own toppings. So it actually, these last few Loony Dog nights have tasted a lot better. And I got to say, with throwing out that first pitch last night, everything tasted fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, too. What's the topping, though?
For me, last night it was we added some fresh tomatoes and a smoky bacon mayo. That was
fancy.
The combination of those two was great.
So no regrets. It sounds like Ryan.
I mean, regrets in that, you know, I hit 140 Loony Dogs on the season, but the fact that it culminated with a first pitch that just wipes everything else out, right?
I don't know if it does. From our archives, that was Neil talking to Jody Matheson and Ryan Rushton, the Loony Dog Kings. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.